Okay, and we're back at it again. My name is Joe, your favorite DJ, and with me here is Ray Ray.
What up?
This is a game a day or a game at a time. We don't know. We never know. We
it's a working title.
Yes, it's a working title that will continue to work itself. And today, yes, as always, we don't have a topic, but I'm just going to update Ray on what Byron told me about the new game that he played, which he gave two stars out of five, and it was called Tales of Arise.
Mm.
And the story of Tales of Arise, Ray, is, what did he tell me? That it is about two planets. There is two planets and one planet, I think, okay, I'm going to get this really wrong. One planet has a group of people called like Terrans, another one's called Darrans, and roughly speaking, and the Terrans came over to the Darrans and essentially try to colonize the Darrans because they were going extinct and they needed new resources. And then hundreds of years later is when the game begins. And at this point in time, the Terrans have gone extinct. But in between them going to extinction and the start of this game, what they did is they took a bunch of Darrans, they put them on a satellite, maybe it's like a moon that's orbiting their planet.
Uh-huh.
And what And these people have special powers. These people have magic and technology. And the story goes that the Terrans, they were running out of resources and they needed to essentially basically farm, either farm the Darrans or use them as some type of fuel or whatever. And but they had so little people, the population was so small that they wanted to use the Darrans to become overlords and govern the Darrans. And so they chose the most talented Darrans and the ones that had magic. And over time, these Darrans, okay, so they took these talented Darrans, sent them up into a satellite that orbits the planet and trained them up, and they became the overlords. And as the
overlords over the remaining Darrans,
of the remaining Darrans, yes,
right.
And as the Terrans died out, these overlord Darrans who has magic evolved to have very powerful magic, whilst the rest of the normal Darrans lost their ability to have magic. And over time, the other thing that happened is these Darrans that have magic thought they were actually the descendants of the
Terrans.
The Terrans.
Right.
Yes, that have essentially gone extinct. So basically you have people of the same race, but one can do magic, the other one cannot. And the one that can do magic think they are genetically different and that they are the descendants of this really powerful ancient species.
So this is a story of a mistaken colonization.
I have no idea. I can only tell the story. I don't fucking understand it.
Well, in the beginning it sounds like it's a story of colonization.
So I'm giving you the setting, so that's how it's set.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start off as a guy who has a mask.
Okay.
And you don't know your name, you don't know anything about yourself. What you do know is that you are a slave. You are a slave. And on this planet, these Darrans, you wake up as one of the Darren slaves, and there is essentially only four of these Terran overlords left.
Who are in actual fact Darrans.
Who are actually in actual fact Darrans.
Right.
Okay. And four or six or ten, whatever the fucking number it is. And the rest of you guys are essentially slaves. And you wake up as one of these men slaves, and for some reason you've been told that to free your people you need to kill these four or six overlords. And so you essentially do a quest, whatever, and over time you band up with a bunch of four or six other people, one of which is a girl who is actually an ex-overlord, but she felt betrayed by her people, and she signed on your side. Then two overlords. One's a girl, one's a guy. That goes to your side because they felt betrayed. Then there is like two or three other people that feel that want to join your quest, basically. And then anyway, totals up to about seven people.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go around and I suppose you just kill the overlords. And over time, but you still think you're a slave. And you still think they're two separate races. But then you go up to the orbit. Spaceship, go into the orbit, go into the ancient satellite orbiting the planet, and you realize the true story. mm-hmm. and that you guys are essentially of the same race. And then somewhere in the middle, one of the girls who is an ex-overlord, she wears pink and she has a curse on her. So that's the reason she essentially came to your side. She was originally overlord,
mm-hmm.
but then she came to your side because she was cursed. Mm-hmm. And it is said that ancient Terrans gave her family, her generation, a curse.
Mm-hmm.
And the curse ray is a very interesting curse. So as far as I can tell, she looked pretty hot. But Byron said she's just a normal girl. Whatever. But her curse is if someone touches her,
mm-hmm.
she delivers pain to them. And it's called thorns. Now Byron didn't explain to me properly, but my understanding is that when someone touches her, she just emits thorns around her. Suddenly she'll just emit thorns like a porcupine.
Right.
But
very apt name.
Yes. But these porcupine, it's not like physical. It's sort of like it's like metaphysical. It's just like an aura that like delivers pain to people.
Right.
And anyway, so she delivers thorns, so she's really fucking pissed off about it. And because she's cursed. Now, that's the first thing. So you touch girl, girl give you thorns. The second thing that Byron told me that at the end of the story is basically the protagonist was a guy with a mask and this girl. And one of the last things that happened is she gets essentially tied up. I don't know how she gets tied up. And because she's being touched, suddenly she's emitting all these thorns.
Right.
Now, and near the end of the game, she's now tied up. She's screaming, you know, and then all the thorns are blasting out of her, whatever the fuck. And suddenly a flower opens up in her chest. Like, yes, that's what Byron said to me. To all the non-listeners out there, Ray's looking at me like, what the fuck? This is what Byron said. Flower opened up in her chest. And the man, the protagonist, takes a sword, which only she can power up using, like, I don't know, her magic. And he sticks that sword into her flower. And then they are freed.
From?
I think then the game's over. I think she... I don't know if she dies at the end, but she. I think she gets released.
From her curse or from slavery?
I don't know. But I think she just gets freed from something that's holding her. Or like chaining her.
That gives a whole new meaning to the flower myth, but okay.
Yes, exactly. So that's exactly what I told Byron, which is like, if you have a girl like that, and you give her a... like a game, and you have a character like that, and you say, hey, look, this girl, if you touch her, she will cause you pain. Like, you're just asking for trouble, right? These things, you can't design games like that without asking for trouble. Anyways, so that is my basic summary of what the story is about.
Can I just say it's a very, very strange feeling
yes.
having Joe describe yes. me a game?
Yes, I... Yeah. Yeah, you haven't listened to the last podcast, but if you did, you'll hear that I'm pretty much just telling you what I heard.
Right.
Yeah. I have a lot of questions. I have like a bunch of questions. Like, you know, like I want to go a bit deeper into what these all mean.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if Byron doesn't want to talk about that sort of stuff or like thinks I'm... you know, overly taking a critical, being a literary critique of this shit. But anyways.
My understanding is that he would have simplified it and like cut details out to make it easier to tell.
Yeah. He treated me like a baby and said, this is too complicated.
I mean, we are trying to like explain like a whole game to you.
Yeah. No, the messier it is, the better, in my opinion.
Really?
To me, yes. Yes. Because... like, it can't be so messy that I don't understand. And at parts, they're so messy that I don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's messy in terms of, like, how do I place it? So long I understand the story,
mm-hmm.
I want to go as deep as possible.
And did you understand the story?
Well, I pretty much told you what the story is. And I have a lot of questions. But one of them, which is, you know, why would a game designer design a character like that, a girl with a curse? You know, I think there's a reason behind it. It probably appeals to certain people. certain demographics. I don't know anything about the gaming world.
That's fine.
That's not really it. But let's just presume that it was intended to appeal to certain players or certain demographics.
Mm-hmm.
Who do you think such a character appeals to? Or this story? Like this story, this character, what I've told you?
Well, even
who would find this shit appealing?
Even before that, I would go, all right, as a game, I would probably, if I have a male lead and a female lead, I'll probably, how do I phrase this? My telling would be like, all right, so the girl would, you either have to create the female as a strong female lead, or you need to put her having some form of distress to place her in the role of damsel in distress at some point.
Yes. Like these common
tropes.
Right. Yeah, keep saying that. But they're essentially the common characters and figures in literary stories and movies that appeals to us.
Yes, and that we are very used to.
Yes.
My understanding is
conflict. You need like internal conflict, emotional conflict. That brings a character alive. It's very, very true. As far as I understand, she's an overlord. She has magic. She's very powerful. But then again, she has this weakness inside. Yes, and she can't be touched. So like, you know, so it's it. Anyone that has conflict within them is an interesting character because essentially you want to see how they resolve their conflict, right? Part of it. Definitely it is. I think I've told you once that with movies, we essentially all know what the ending is, right? With all the movies, we generally know, the character, you know, he's gonna save the damsel. But we want to know how.
Right.
You know? They do it in a different way every time. And that is what, like, people go, well, we all know what the story ending is. Why do we watch it? You know, it's not that interesting. Well, people will say that probably missed the point. We all know how things will end. Well, like, and I will all know how we all will end. We're all going to be buried 6 feet underground or something along those lines.
Eventually.
Right? But the entertainment and the meaningful aspect of being part of the story or wanting to learn about these stories is how. You know, how do they end up 6 feet underground? You know? Because everyone does it in a different way. Every time, you know, like James Bond, you know, something's going to happen. He's going to save the world. He's, you know, going to meet a girl, save the girl, kill some bad guys, have some interesting weapons, and that's it, right? There's nothing, like, non-formulaic about it. It's just a formula. But you want to see how he does it every time.
You don't think part of the appeal is the chance that it may not follow common movie or book tropes or whatever? Story tropes?
Well, that's the thing, which is there is structure, and the question is, there's two things we can do, I think, which is do you escape the structure or do you not? And if you don't escape the structure, then you're given a set of tools or set of objects and in within a film. And as a storyteller, you figure out how to sort of it's like cooking. You're given the same set of tools and ingredients as everyone else. And the world wants to see how you do it. And sometimes you might break the rules, yes. Breaking the rules is great, generally speaking. But yeah. But you don't necessarily need to break the rules. In fact, if you can conform to the rules and yet be creative and do something no one has seen before, that's part of what is magical. It's very, very easy to break the rules and then, you know, do something. It's very easy to do something different. The question is whether doing something different is really an achievement or not is probably the question. Like if, you know, I don't know, sticking to, you know, James Bond, if he suddenly does a tap dance, yeah, there's probably no James Bond that did a tap dance or James Bond that does a musical. But the thing is, you gotta really be able to pull it off. Right? It's not that people go, oh, how ingenious is this? No one has tried that before. Let's do it. But that's really not ingenious. That's just adding an idea. Like merely suggesting something that hasn't happened before is not ingenuity,
mm-hmm.
Right? A lot of ingenuity comes down to having the same ingredients that everyone else has, building something that's quite different.
True,
right? That's my opinion, anyways. What do you think?
I just lost my train of thought. What am I going to go with? Give me a moment, sorry. My original thought was, as you were talking, I was thinking about just tropes in general and how, like, you want to escape the mold, because if the mold is the same with every film,
yes,
you know where the film is going, and you get bored with it quickly because you can predict everything.
But that's what I'm saying, which is yes and no. Because technically, with every James Bond film or with every Disney cartoon or whatever it is, you know how the ending will end.
Yes.
Right? You know the beginning, and you basically can guess what the end is. And if you can't, then you're a little bit moronic.
Yeah.
Basically, you can.
Yep.
But that's not the point already.
No, but it's how they get to the end.
How they get there. Right?
And in between, they can...
It's not the destination that matters. It's how you get there.
And along the way, they can break whatever rules, and that's what...
Sometimes they break the rules, sometimes they don't, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm trying to say, which is something that when you witness someone not breaking any of the rules, and yet it seems totally ingenious and wonderful, it probably dazzles and amazes you a lot more, right? I can't really think of an example right now.
And that's what you're terming ingenuity.
Yeah. That's taking a risk just as much. And it's probably more difficult. But it's... Think about it. Every artist starts with a brush and paint. Okay, let's just assume, right? You have like 7 colors, a canvas, and a brush. And that's it. And yet some people make stuff that, like, you go, very, very nice. And other people, you go, no, not very nice. And then you have people who, you know, do some Picasso shit, and you go, all right, I'm not sure how to feel about this, but god damn it, it's fucking different. And then you have someone like, you know, Van Gogh, who, like, just decides to make art 3D, essentially. He essentially uses the oil as a form of, as a visual.
Mm.
Not for 2D space, but for 3D space. So that's
where the portrait or painting almost shuts out at you.
Yeah, he pretty much does, right? Mm. He just adds a lot of paint on. So, I mean, technically all these guys had, you know, the same thing, right? They had a canvas, some paint, and a brush.
Okay, to pull this back into the gaming landscape,
yes.
I believe early games very much had the same sort of idea where people, like, the gaming hardware is their brush and paint. They were very limited by their hardware, and because of that, they had to be ingenious with its design. For example, my understanding of, like, the first Mario level was that they were limited by their hardware, which is why there is no tutorial, and they had to depend upon the player themselves to figure out how to traverse the world.
Yes.
That's very similar to all the I'm gonna say forerunners of the gaming world. Zelda, Mario, Sonic. I mean, you've played a Sonic game before. We both played Sonic games as children.
Yes.
When you press go, you're basically thrown into the world. And you have to figure out where to go by yourself.
I mean, Sonic the Hedgehog was exactly like Mario. You had to go right. You couldn't go left.
You could go left, but then there was a wall.
Yes.
Which you realized, if there was a wall, I cannot go this way anymore.
Yes. So then you have to go right.
Which also
then you jump, and then you hurt yourself, and then you realize rings are lost.
Yes.
Right? And slowly you just figure yourself out as a kid. I mean, you got to give yourself time. As an adult, I'll never do that shit now.
Mm-hmm.
The funny, interesting thing is, if I can't... As an adult, if I sit down and I can't figure it out after 2 minutes, I'm probably just not interested in it. The world changes, I think, as you get a bit older. But yeah,
but
it's the same formula, pretty much.
But in that sense, Mario. Are we being... I don't say that we are being babied now. Because now... Because with the gaming landscape, when you don't have the internet, you have to figure that shit out. Yes. But now, if I don't have an answer to the question, I look it up online and I get the answer very, very easily.
Correct.
I don't think we're being... No, I think the landscape's just changed. And if when the landscape changes, the players must change too. And if the players change, that means people who are producing
like the games must change as well. Over time, you sort of... Just like, you know, you and Byron understand the language of games, and I don't. Immersing yourself probably in anything that's complex, over time you'll learn the language. It's you know, you guys...
Well, you understand painting and artwork much better than I do.
Yes, I mean, I wouldn't say I understand a lot better than a lot of other people, but yes, that is correct. It's because you immerse yourself in this thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you immerse yourself in a certain arena of some kind, you all the time you start to understand the language of that arena. And it's whether... And so two things can happen, right? That language can welcome new entrants, or that language doesn't welcome. That language is very, very difficult to adopt as a beginner. You need to be taught. It's sort of like, you know, classical piano. It's like, if you don't really... Someone don't teach you form and scale and classical chords, you're just going to have very, very... And reading the, you know, sheet music, you're going to have a fucking difficult time. You basically cannot get yourself up there. There's this idea that coaches are very important.
Mm. Yes.
It's very, very true. Coaching is super important. And the question maybe that's worth asking today is whether games require coaches. Can one just play games, or any game, it'll work out, or do you need to be coached, or do you need to play certain games in a certain order in order for you to appreciate much more difficult games for themselves? For example, Byron and I talked about Hole. Is that called Portal?
Portal. Yes. Yep.
And I didn't really appreciate it. Even though it was a game for like beginners.
The idea of coaches, that's an interesting topic, because previously you were your own coach, you had to learn it yourself. Now there's coaches, again, the landscape has changed. There's coaches everywhere. You go on YouTube, you watch a playthrough, is basically someone who has done it before.
Yes.
And you're being coached by...
Yeah, that's a one-way coach. That's, yes. 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 A two-way coach is basically someone that will look at your performance and tell you and give you essentially tailored, personalized opinion and tell you how to improve yourself.
Which exists in multiplayer games. I mean, everybody around you is your coach in that sense.
Yeah, good coaches, bad coaches, but nevertheless coaches. Yes, I totally agree. Yes.
Hmm.
Yeah. So the question is... if you want to learn something quickly, you generally need a bit of coaching.
Mm.
That's the first thing. If you also want to know something that is in depth, it's far easier, far more likely to succeed if you have a set of coaches that help you along the way.
Because they've already walked down the path. They will lead you down the path that they have walked. And
yes, because otherwise you have to essentially reinvent the wheel every time.
Mm.
Whilst they sort of just tell you the basic formula to move on. And then from there you can develop yourself. Yeah, it's very difficult to succeed, I reckon, in life in almost anything without a coach. So the idea of, you know, individuals being totally independent and void of other people's communication, interaction, all of that is basically a tiny bit bullshit.
Who is the void of social interactions here?
But it's not just social interaction, it's a certain type of social interaction. Right? But if you want to learn in something or succeed in something, you'll find... I mean, if you're the first person to be in that world, then you don't have a coach. But then you're not expected to succeed either. So that's why pioneers do not succeed.
I mean, it's what... What do they say? They say we stand on the shoulders of giants.
Exactly, yes. Mimicry, right? Imitation. Imitation
is the best form of flattery.
Yeah. You know, like, even in business, right? Who makes more money? Those that innovate or those that copy? And it's very, very clear. Those that copy is far more profitable than those that innovate. Yeah. There is this idea from... I might be wrong about this. Peter Thiel, is that right? That he says it's better to invent ideas than no one has ever done. But even him is really... stand on the shoulders of giants and copying, but just doing it in a more interesting way. It's like Tesla. Tesla didn't invent any technology, it just made existing technology so much better. So like iPhone as well, that they pretty much created their own industry. And people just think they founded the industry. I guess they did found the industry, but they want
They found the marriage between, I assume, multiple industries, and then what they popped out was their own thing.
Yes, exactly, yes. The ingenious part is they took the experts of many different areas, put them together and tell them, you know, put them all in a room and said, hey, dance, you know. Mm. So I have no idea what I'm talking about now, but basically, yes, with games, there's probably a language with games, and certain games is easy to adopt, easy to understand, like Tetris. And some games are maybe very, very difficult and takes a lot of work to understand. Maybe it's very meaningful games, you know.
Do you think... Okay, I have a question, which yes. I doubt you can answer, which yes. is, do you think the gaming
landscape... I like that, yes.
Do you think that the gaming landscape is too segregated? As in...
Yes.
One someone who plays one particular game,
yes.
their skills cannot translate to a different game.
Yes.
And you can, if you want, you can expand this towards any form of art form, yes. such as painting, piano. Someone who draws, I don't know what's called, squarism, cannot draw Van Gogh style. Someone who does postmodern cannot do romantic.
Yes, yes.
In terms of paintings. Do you think, like...
That is a problem.
The base of this question is, yes. do you think skills are transferable, and if they are transferable, how much of the skill is transferable?
Are we talking about games, or I can talk about it from another perspective?
I'd like you to eventually hit games.
Okay.
But you can start it from anywhere.
Okay.
Okay, I'll tell you the reason behind this question.
Yes.
The reason is, at one point, we were talking about Renaissance people versus people now. We were talking about specialization.
Yes.
My God, I think you mentioned something yesterday where, maybe it wasn't you, but it was before industrialization,
yes.
you could wake up as a astronomer and go to sleep as a poet.
Yes, that's what Marx said.
Okay, yeah, there you go.
Yeah. That was one of the reasons, motivations to come up with communism. Why socialism is important. Yeah, so it's very, very correct. So, in Marx's mind, Karl Marx, that is, he said, well, firstly, he was an economist. You know, people think he was a crazy guy, but he was actually an economist, and he looked at the world through capital. And back, traditional economics think of the word capital not as, you know, money, but as inputs into essentially a manufacturing process that will generate useful outputs. So what does that mean? So if the output is clothes, then the input is cotton, machinery, labor, and maybe money. And these four things are all considered capital traditionally. And what Marx said is, well, to think all of them is capital is pointless, because there's different forms of capital. There is tools, a factory, which you need to make clothes. There is cotton. There is money. And there is labor. And the worker owns his work. The worker owns his capital. So labor is capital. And that is owned by, you know, the worker. But every other form of capital is not owned by the worker. He does not control himself. Every other form of capital is owned by someone else. So anyway, from there, he essentially concluded, look, if you work in a factory and the output is not food, you can work, be exploited, and not be able to feed yourself. And unfortunately, a factory that requires capital to produce goods, every form of capital is not owned by the worker. And even his work himself is no longer owned by himself, because if he doesn't, well, it's owned by himself, but he doesn't have to be paid much for it. So why did that matter to Marx? Because Marx said, look, back in Renaissance days, back in the Enlightenment, a man could wake up as a poet and sleep as an artist, right? Mm-hmm. So a man could be, you know, an astronomer, a botanist, a philosopher, all of that, artist. That's what it was, right? There were a lot of people in those days. And he said, well, the Industrial Revolution is killing that, because now factories do not allow the worker or the individual to do that, because he is a slave to capital, or he's slave to capitalism. And here Marx differentiates the human labor capital with money capital, or the ownership of other forms of capital. And Marx said workers can't wake up as a poet and sleep as a writer. You know, they have to essentially do two things. They have to commit their time and effort to work a certain amount of hours.
Yep.
And second of all, they must be trained or exploited to integrate the other form of capital together. In other words, if you work at a Ford car factory and you're bolting wheels, that's all you did for 8 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And then are you paid enough to do something else? And the answer was no. So that was Marx's critique of capitalism. And that's why he said we need to go up the chain of the value chain of, you know, of social development, which is we need to move from feudalism to capitalism, capitalism to socialism, socialism to communism. So that's why people don't get it, but a lot of socialist countries and communist countries, and even in social democracies in Europe, don't consider capitalism to be the ultimate good. It's essentially only the Americans that think that way.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone believes capitalism. There could be something better than capitalism. Not just there's something better than capitalism, but all of them sort of look down upon the American approach, which is that capitalism, pure capitalism in itself, is good enough, is the best form, and they just don't believe that. So anyways, that's where that idea comes from. And coming back to your question, Marx did it because he thought, and he did it from a point of philosophy. He believed the human is born to reach his potential and to realize his potential. Every individual is there to do that. And therefore, an individual shouldn't be resigned to just, you know, being a nurse, being a doctor, being a lawyer. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
He ought to be able to realize his full potential, which is that he is the master of his own destiny, and that he can have infinite skill sets, that he can explore the world through his abilities, and that's not confined to one set of skills, right? So he can essentially be a poet, be an artist, be all of that.
Hasn't he hope people are like this, or that people...
Well, that's his ideal view of what a good life is.
Right.
So you have to understand, which is that communism, this idea of communism really comes down to, is motivated by his belief that the individual can live his best life through communism. So people think communism is about people bring their food to, you know, bring their resources together and redistributing it. But to Marx, actually, ultimately comes down, he thinks that's the best way to serve the individual, which is if we work together, everyone is better off. Which is also what free market is about. But free market says the invisible hand will do it. Or Marx sort of says, we don't want the invisible hand. We should intentionally own all of our resources collectively, right?
So both sides believe that the sum will be greater than the combined.
Yes, totally correct. Both approaches, whether, you know, the liberal free market approach, they call it laissez-faire, right? Which is the French term for, like, I don't know what it means. I suppose it just means freedom or free market. That is to say, you know, people just, you know, get into a room, you know, and start dancing, and then people will figure it out. It's total free markets. And the other way, the communist system, is that the workers in the world would essentially wake up one day and realize the best way we can all live a good life is if we combine the output of our work together. And the basic idea is to those, from those, their ability, to those, their need. So from each of the person that you produce based on their ability, and will redistribute to everyone based on their need, which is his way of saying, look, this is the best way of someone living their great life.
We were taught that, at least I was taught that the individual is greedy, and that people will do the minimum that is required of them and no more.
That is firstly the you're totally right. That is sort of the American view on things. It's also the American Western critique of Russia, and it's also the fundamental assumption in basic modern economics.
That's what I'm not sure about you, but that's what I've been taught a few times now from uni. And that's why Russia Was that Russia cut? Oh, no, that was why the Chinese system didn't completely work or something
like that. Yeah. Because, yeah, under the collectivization policies of the 50s and 60s, where the farmer essentially formed into brigades, right? So instead of them, what do they call it? Production units? Whatever they're called. So instead of producing food for themselves, they'll produce food for some, you know, other party that's independent to them. Which one would they work harder? The basic idea is the farmer will work harder if they produce enough food for themselves.
That's the idea.
And that's basically what free market economics and, you know, capitalism is about. Or what Gordon Gekko in the late 1980s said, which is greed is good, right? And it's also what I think Adam Smith said when he said, you know, nothing motivates the individual more than self-interest. So that could be true. That mm-hmm. could be true.
Could be true.
It's easier to understand from that point of view, but it's not necessarily the case, I don't think.
Right.
And the reason it's not necessarily the case is, I can give you an example, which is system thinking, cult thinking, and kinship factors can motivate people more than their individual self does. You can sort of look like an ant colony. An ant colony, like the individual sort of sacrifices for the collective colony. Or you might say, oh well, the ant doesn't know he has self-interest or he has a collective will, but actually the ant, if he was self-interested, he'll probably get fucked, because the rest of the colony will go, oh, you selfish motherfucker, I'll kill you. So that ant can't behave in self-interest. And even if he behaves in self-interest, what is he going to do? The rest of the colony is serving the queen, not serving him. So it depends on what the system also allows and welcomes and supports. You know? It's just like, you know, the church.
Mm-hmm.
If you suddenly act selfishly, what do you think will happen? I mean, you can be self-interested and you can, you know, every time you go to church, you know, people throw out the charity box or charity bucket, charity hat, whatever they're called, and you can take it every time, but ultimately you get kicked out of church. So it's not as simple as that, which is you need a system that welcomes, as they call it, you know, individual aspiration, individual, and you know, the sense of the sense that the individual can, they say, like pull his own shoestraps or pull his own bootstraps.
Mm-hmm.
Out of his own hole, right? So some societies allow that, but some societies don't. And the problem with allowing that is there's a lot of chaos, because if you allow a lot of self-interest and not a lot of rules, well then you should basically expect there to be a lot of breach of trust, values, whatever that is collectively understood will be breached. Because the best way of getting yourself out of a shitty situation in a system of rules is to break the rules.
That
doesn't make sense?
Makes sense.
Yeah, so self-interest works very well in a system that has very, very little rules. And that could be good or could be bad. It's good for the individual, but it might be very chaotic as a system.
Right.
Yeah. So let me ask you this, right? Which is like, for example, and maybe furthermore, maybe you don't want there to be no rules. I mean, literally, there's a reason why humans are organized in the way we do. We organize ourselves in hierarchies,
mm-hmm.
and social patterns that is sort of that has implicit rules of understanding. Like you and I, you know, operate in a certain way,
mm-hmm.
right? We speak a certain language. We respect each other. Like, I'm not punching you in the face or whatever the fuck it is. I'm not, like, you know, getting your wallet and, like, stealing your money and so that. Why is that? Right? Maybe you would think a self-interested person would do so, but they don't. Why? Because they realize that, you know, maybe they can, you know, steal one person's wallet, but there are broader consequences because society has rules. So the idea of free markets, it's not exactly free market. There is, like, a lot of...
So what do you call people who do not follow these rules, that would steal from their sibling's wallet? Would you call them deviants?
No, I mean, no. Well, no, there's just two set of... Well, there's probably... We're getting a bit deep into this, but you know, in basically in the social sciences, and I mean this is where like the arts sort of matter, which is there are rules in this world, and we call them laws.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it interesting that laws can be changed, in the sense that who makes the laws? Well, technically it's a parliament, right? Mm-hmm. Or who populates a parliament? Representatives, right? But these representatives, I guess, are people, and then ultimately laws are created by people. Mm-hmm. And therefore, when I say laws can be created by people or is created by people, what am I also implicitly saying? That these laws are also changed by people.
Yes.
Right? So those that are in the position to be able to change laws are they're far more likely to be comfortable in breaking the law because they know they can just change it. In other words, they can change things retroactively.
Fair enough.
Yeah, and that's a system that essentially embeds power, embeds influence, and all that sort of stuff. There's an idea of which about free markets essentially tends towards monopolies, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tends towards concentration of power.
Yep.
Yeah. It's because power scales non-linearly.
Yep.
Right? It's like if I'm by myself, let's say if I have one friend, my ability to punch a hole in your head scales non-linearly. Right? If that makes sense.
No, I agree.
Yes. And then, so I punch a hole in your head, so then you don't want to get punched, you join me, now I have three friends, right? And the three of us collectively feel more powerful together than as an individual, right? So then you join, there's three of us, and I go to you, I say, Ray, who don't you like? You tell me, no, I don't like this guy, Mr. White. And we go and punch a hole in his head, right? It's very easy now, the three of us. And Mr. White said, you know what? I don't really want to have my head punched. Why don't I join you? So now we have four people. So that's why power doesn't scale linearly. Now, of course, the four of us might be in a very chaotic system.
Mm-hmm.
That's unclear, right? But what we do understand is that the four of us, if we were to organize ourselves together, we're actually organizing ourselves together by binding ourselves to a set of rules. So now
to a single cause. As long as this cause exists, we are...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. As long as maybe there's a cause that we share or interest that we share, we actually bound our behavior together in a set of rules.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's not socialism. I mean, now it is sort of like socialism. This is no longer a free market between the four of us. It actually, there is a set of rules, right? And if any of us were to break the rules, probably the three of us would then punish them. Mm-hmm. So now we have laws.
Internal laws between right? us four, yes.
Yes, so as you scale up, what's going on? You basically, this four of us is sort of expanding like the plague, right? You're growing in a non-linear fashion and your power is sort of dominating the society in non-linear fashion. In fact, a good analog of that is probably just a virus or a bacteria expanding in a petri dish,
mm-hmm.
which is at the beginning you just sample different bacteria, but suddenly they just become colonies. And if one bacteria is able to eat another bacteria, what do you think happens? Like you don't know which bacteria will win, but you know one of them is going to dominate the whole petri dish sooner or later. That's free market, right? That is a market without rules, basically.
Hmm.
Now, you come back to the question, is self-interest the best for the individual? It's unclear. The world
has evolved to be
very... Well, the West has evolved... Well, the world has evolved to be very sophisticated. And the idea that it's just a free market is total bullshit. It's free market given a set of rules. Like, it's not really free market, right? We have fair competition. We have ACCC, right? Which is anti-competition and consumer commission, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
We have, antitrust, right? In America, it's like you can't have monopolies. We have rules that essentially protect consumer from defects. We have rules that can prosecute people for lying. It's not a free market.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just do whatever you want, right?
It's free as long as you stay within these confines.
Yeah, you can do whatever you want within the confines. And people previously said, well, this is what you call free, fair, and transparent. So the rules that essentially the Europeans then created it, said, okay, laissez-faire is bullshit. We can't just have no fucking rules. We're going to have rules. And the rules are the following. They have to be fit, free, fair, and transparent. Right? Free is difficult. Means basically the rules have allows to behave freely, but at the same time, we must treat each other fairly. Means we can't steal from each other. And must be transparent, which means my intentions are to reveal to you, right? Now, you know, in Chinese economics, they call this a bird being locked in a cage, right? Which is a bird is allowed to fly around freely so long they're in a cage.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, let's just put it this way. Australia is not exactly a free market. The economy is actually quite, because of its high tax, because it taxes people, relatively high tax. It's a socialist model. It's a social democracy. It's not a pure capitalistic economy. People say it is, but it's not. You get taxed for mm-hmm. making money, yeah. And it's what you call progressive tax, which means if you make more, you get taxed more. And that money flows down to the poor. There's redistribution going on. And from that point of view, Marx is correct. Because overall, Australia is quite a successful society, right? It's relatively peaceful, life is good here, and so forth. But if the system works not because of free competition, the idea of free competition is actually a little bit bullshit.
I'm still a bit hung up about the bird in a birdcage analogy.
Yeah, bird in a birdcage. That was what the Chinese described capitalism being implemented in China. So the bird is all the state-owned enterprises and privately owned and entrepreneurs in the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
And the cage is the rules that the state and the Communist Party have set in place. So they can fly and do whatever they want, mm-hmm. so long they behave within the rules.
But in that case, my next question is redundant.
Yeah.
But
it was created by a guy, I think, called Chen Yun, who was the architect of Chinese, modern Chinese economy. He was an economist from mm-hmm. Shanghai, and his family was from a relatively, I think, business-oriented family, if I remember correctly, and he described it as bird in a cage.
Okay, that's fair then.
Yeah. So now coming back to the topic, really long, windy road, we're going to try and get this back, which is, the way you play games, does it matter that one game cannot play, or one a player of one sort of game cannot interact? Well, is it a problem that in the gaming world, players playing one game do not understand players that play another game, right? Which is sort of like coming back to the question that Marx asked, which was, is it a honorable and
okay? Yeah. At the end of the day, the question is:
yes.
Are we slaves to our skills? Which is, I think, something that you mentioned maybe 10 minutes ago.
Oh, are we slaves to our skills?
As in, I have learned this skill. Yes. Am I a slave to it, or can I go somewhere else and like do something else?
Unfortunately, I think that literally, that's a very good question. I think this pretty much defines class. I think if you're slave to a skill, you are of a certain class. And if your skill is a slave to you, you are of a different class. It's exactly what money is about, right? Let's not worry about what, we can come back to Marxist economics on this, which is, what is a skill? A skill is really just a means of generating money, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's put it simply from his perspective.
Sure.
So if you are a slave to money,
mm-hmm.
then you are of a certain class. And if money is slave to you, then it's of another class, right? So in other words, what Marx is saying is you have to work all day just to make some money. Or like, if you didn't have this skill, you'll be useless to the world. You won't be able to live. You don't live without you having this skill. So in that sense, such that an example will be, you know, someone, a car technician,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah, he's a slave to his skill unless he's able to live a happy life even without employing that skill, right? So you have the ability to be a great car technician, but you're not necessarily, you know, bounded to execute that skill and every day.
Okay. So if how do I tie this back in?
Mm.
So if I am able, well, according to Marx,
yes,
the point, my interpretation was that, from what you've just said, was that, yes,
I might be wrong about the finer points of Marx, but I think I'm relatively correct.
Well, my understanding was that the point of living a life,
yes,
is to explore the best of my life that I can.
Yes. Live the best life that you can.
Live the best life that, yes, I can.
And what does that mean, right?
Yes.
And what does that mean? That's what Marx was trying to say, which was, we all want to live the best life that we can.
Yes.
Right? Well, that's what he thought.
Yes.
How? What does that mean? And his idea is, well, the individual ought to be able to do many, many things. And,
yes. But reality is...
And the reality that they faced during the Industrial Revolution, when there were workers being slave labor in the factories. Factory back then is not factory now. Factory back then, you know, people had poor health, there were, you know, no water, there was no sanitation, the air was polluted with, you know, burning of coal, blah, blah, blah. It was a terrible
situation. But are we not still slaves to our own skills? As in, if I learn, I mean, that's the whole point of, yes, let's say,
I mean,
learning a skill. If I learn to be a pilot, I'm, yes, a fucking pilot. I'm not a race car driver.
Well, yeah, I mean, Marx said he didn't want workers to be exploited. In other words, workers shouldn't be slaves to their work.
Mm-hmm.
Or he would say, potentially, there's a class between, class difference in capitalists and workers, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But is there actually a problem being a slave to your skill? The question is, if you like a skill, you don't mind being a slave to it. We're all slaves to something.
Sure.
Yes.
If you like your skill, you don't mind. Sure.
Yeah.
And upon the idea that you play games for enjoyment, if I develop a skill of, say, I'm going to say racing games.
Yeah.
If I develop the skills of playing a racing game.
Yes.
This translates to, can I change another game and be comfortable playing another game, even though I have developed this single skill, this one skill, of playing racing games?
Yes.
And what was the link? The link was that, yes, if I develop the skill of being a car mechanic, I cannot go and be, say, a painter, because I haven't fully developed that skill. Which translates to...
But do you want to have the freedom to be able to learn how to be a painter?
We all have the freedom of doing that.
I think you're very lucky to be able to think you can say that. I don't think everyone has the freedom to do that. Nor do people feel they have the freedom to do that.
I think everybody... if you're willing to give up whatever you held before, everyone has that...
But sometimes you can't give things up, right? Like,
well, no, you can't give things up. Yeah. That's the issue. You need these skills in order to, yes, live, right?
Not just live, but you need to be able to feed... Yes, exactly. You need to be able to feed yourself. And what Marx was saying is, you know, unless these people work 8 hours a day or 10 hours a day, they couldn't feed themselves. So you literally need to allocate... You are a slave to those 8 hours. Or 10 hours or whatever. So don't think you have 24 hours in a day, right? You know, you need, like, 8 hours to sleep, you know, 3 hours to eat, whatever, 3 hours to exercise, 8 hours to work. You're left with 2 hours of time that's for yourself. So in 24 hours, you only have 2 hours for yourself. That is what is the difference. That is what he's saying in terms of the different classes. One class has 8 hours a day dedicated to themselves. The other has 2 hours a day dedicated to themselves. Might not seem like much, but as always, time, the acquirement of skill and ability, again, doesn't scale linearly with time. So after a sufficient amount of time, you just get it. So there is no way one can compete fairly, right? One that has 8 hours a day dedicated to themselves versus another that has two. And of those two, is likely to be diminished 2 hours. It's not, you know, you're not using the two best hours of your day to be helping you know, cultivating yourself. Does it make sense or does it not make sense?
I think it makes sense right now.
Yes. if you want to be the best version that you can be, you need to dedicate all your time, effort, and resources to generally that one thing. That's what the free market pretty much does to you. And if you take a look at anyone that is successful in any area or endeavor in this world today, which one of them spends nearly 2 hours of their day practicing and doing that? None. Which one of them are dedicating their whole entire lives, day in, day out, week in, week out? Right? So your idea that, oh, anyone can just do anything, you need to think about, can they actually do anything? And that's the tough part. Because the reality of the situation for almost everyone, and unless they have capital, which is
what's all the capital.
So unless they have, so if you have, if you, it could be given to you by, generally speaking, in our world today, it's given to you by family or parents, right? Which is they'll give you housing, therefore you don't have to pay rent. They will, you know, they might make a meal for you, which means you don't have to cook yourself or whatever. They might provide a clothing and shelter, all that to you, and therefore you don't have to provide that. Then you have a lot of time for yourself. But if you don't have that support, and you need to do that yourself, there's no way. There is literally no way. And it literally creates a class system. Whether people like to hear about this or not. But you know, I might be wrong, but so all the non-listeners out there, challenge me, right? It's very, very difficult. It's either, the way you probably want to think about it is, everybody is a machine and everybody requires some level of maintenance. And I'm not just talking to people, I'm talking about gamers, all of that sort of stuff. You want to play a game, whatever, you need some type of, you need an amount of resource just to maintain you. It could be to maintain your eye health, to maintain your hand health, to reflexes. Maintain your reflexes, whatever. Or it may be even to just fund your, you know, daily internet costs, whatever it is. That maintenance is a cost that has to come from somewhere.
Mm.
And if you are not getting that maintenance essentially for free by someone else, you won't be able to compete, because you have to go and get that. You know, you have to essentially pay for that maintenance somehow, and usually that's through work. And it separates people. It separates people in a very big way. You'll see it. You see being separate. Actually, people are separated even from young age. We talk about coaches. Mm-hmm. One of the good examples is, can you afford a coach? Because if you can afford a coach, that coach will probably also reduce your... They'll do two things. Probably reduce the amount of training time you require,
mm-hmm.
and also increase the amount of efficiency and from per hour of training. So if you have a coach, a good quality coach, you can probably acquire the same skill for half the amount of time or a third amount of time. And again, these things scale linearly, right? If you have the best coach in the world, after 10 years, you'll probably be an Olympian, be a world champion, be the best gamer in the industry, whatever it is. Yeah. There's two aspects. Can you maintain yourself? And above that, can you buy yourself a coach? I think. Well, not buy yourself. Invite yourself. Get access to. But these are the world, real world dynamics out there.
Yeah. No, all I have to say, that is, a coach is just another cost at that point as well.
It is another cost. And I mean, firstly, you'll agree with me, there's probably no decent gaming team or whatever out there that does not practice regularly, and that probably they had some foundation, whatever it is. Anyways, if they're in that team, they practice regularly, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they have a coach, right?
Mm-hmm.
And their success is likely to be exponentially higher if they're marketable, because then they have a market or a fat audience base that will pay them, and they'll have marketing team, obviously. They'll have marketing manager or like an agent that will, you know, sell their image to different sponsors. And that makes it easier because now
they don't have to do it themselves.
They don't have to do it themselves. Now it's a self-perpetuating machine, right? Right?
That's the hope.
Because they just train. They have a coach that trains them. But they have a fan base that supports them. The fan base supporting them means they'll have sponsorship. The fans might give them support. So now they now have inputs, mm-hmm. right? They now have inputs to their gaming factory, where their gaming factory, what are the inputs? Skill, players, cash, what is their outputs? I don't know, championships, mm-hmm. you know, tournaments, right? And how do you get to that level? Well, you got to be able to get all that input. All those inputs have to arrive at your door. And if it doesn't, you have to gather them. That's probably the way you should think, right? Just as a fucking engineer, if you want to figure out anything in this world, whatever output you desire, you need to figure out, well, what are the inputs to get those outputs? And figure out, do you need to gather those inputs, or do the inputs actually just arrive on your doorsteps? Like, you know?
And can I choose my inputs?
No. Well, you have to be an engineer. No, you have to think about what is required. It's a fucking machine. It's not, you can't just, you know, imagine shit out thin air and it's going to work. Like, if you want to write a game, what are the inputs? You probably, developers, designers, coders, people that know how to market, you know, distributors. You need those inputs. Mm. Either those inputs are at your doorstep already. In other words, they're your friends already. They want to work for you already. Or you have to go find them. And the difference between those two is essentially night and day. It's very obvious.
A lot to think about.
Yeah. I mean, the basic structure of these things is not difficult. Whatever output you want in life, you have to figure out the inputs. And then you have to ask yourself, are the inputs in front of me or not? Right? Mm-hmm. The alternative is to go, what are the inputs I have? And what are the outputs I can generate from this input? And then the question is, well, do I want to generate that output?
Mm. Is what I'm investing in worth it?
Yes.
Therefore, my output.
Yes. So someone might be a technician for a car, or a mechanic. That's his input. Mm. He goes, well, I know how to fix cars. What can I use to, you know, generate an output? You know, they can fix cars at a local mechanic shop. They can fix cars at Formula One. Might be a totally different set of skills, but let's presume it's the same set of skills. Or they might, you know, increasingly people now, they fucking create TikTok videos or tutorial videos, or they might teach the damn thing. Or they might build their own car. They're all different types of outputs, but using the same input.
Is it okay to desire a subpar output?
I mean, you can desire a subpar, but why would you do so? I mean, what? But
the question comes from, should you always aim to be the best? Is the road to be the best always worth it? Because if you're not aiming to be your best, yes. You're aiming for a subpar output, no?
You should aim to be the best and be happy to fall short, right? Don't they say, pray for the best, prepare for the worst? Isn't that the basic
approach to life?
Yeah.
What was it? Pray for the best, prepare for the worst.
Yeah.
That sounds like a very, or that's, this is something you'd say to me. Like,
yes.
You say that sounds like a very, beta is not the term you used. That's a very low self-esteem answer, I think you used to say to me.
It could be. But that's what you need to be, I think. You should always try to be the best. But not for its own... I don't know. I think you should always put an effort in what you do.
Sure.
But where that output lies, you don't know. Because...
But aren't I the one that...
But what is the best, you know? Like, do you even know what the benchmark is? Is it relative to you or relative to the industry or what? Like, there are gamers and there are gamers, right? Who is the best gamer out there, right? Tell me. Do you know who it is?
No, I do not.
Yes. Then you have a very, very difficult time figuring out what is best. If you don't know what your target is, or where your target is, you know, how, where are you going to shoot? Where are you going to land? Where are you going to aim? You can't, right? It's a bit tough. Sometimes if you know what your target is, it helps.
Mm-hmm.
I would say you should have a target,
mm-hmm.
and you should feel... When you say, should you feel good being subpar, that's a really dumb question, because you essentially already imply that you're not going to be happy at the end of it because it's subpar. But you should have a target that is reasonable. The idea of flow, right? Which is, it ought to be difficult enough that you can't just easily get it, but not so difficult that it's impossible to reach. Because a lot of people have impossible goals. They don't know it, but, you know, they... I mean, if they feel miserable about themselves because they have unrealistic expectations, no one's fault but theirs.
Sure. Look, I imagine the question as a journey from point A to point B.
Yeah.
And during that journey, is it okay to stop at some point along this line and go, I am happy with where I am. I don't need to get to the very end. Where the very end is either... Where I assume you're on a grade of, like, the further into the journey you are, the better you are in whatever.
I think that's too abstract for me to fully comprehend. But generally, if you want to turn around or you want to stop, it has to be for a good reason, I think. It can't just be...
Well, that doesn't exactly help, but okay.
Yeah, I basically think anyone who says this is enough, I am content, has to really self-reflect and go, are you content because, how do I put it? Is it truly contentment, or is it something that you just resounded to? The best way is to think about it, in my opinion, is like this, which is, let's say you are a caveman and you're hunting an elephant or killing a saber-toothed tiger.
Sure.
And you've injured them.
Sure.
And the question is, do you feel content? That is not the time to ask yourself that question. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But if the elephant has run away and you're really tired, you can't be fucked chasing after it, then maybe you can ask that question. Right? You have to differentiate those two. Success obviously is defined as you kill the fucking elephant, you kill that tiger, right? But a guy that halfway kills the elephant, halfway kills the tiger, and says, I am content, they, you know, their genes will die out. Their genes won't last. That genetic material is shithouse material. You can't stop halfway. Because the other, you know,
that's very interesting. Because I'm thinking of shooting wildlife as game, where your point is not to kill them anymore, right? Even though that's what you're
think caveman days.
Yes,
right? Yes.
You kill them halfway.
They're not dead.
They're not dead.
Yeah, and now you say, I'm content. He's injured. He's probably gonna run away.
Yep.
That is a fucking stupid decision to make.
Yep.
Right? If you can, because then you literally are the loser beta guy in your band of, you know, cavemen. Because some guy will be like, guys, like, we gotta act as a team. This is a dangerous animal. Or if we kill this animal, we all get to eat. Let's push ahead. There's a tiny bit more. That's why inspiration is important. That's why teamwork is important. Someone pushing you through is important. But essentially, those people that can push that last mile is fundamentally, they maybe they're just genetically superior. Mind and matter, I think.
That makes sense to me.
Yes.
But at the same time, you can't tip too much into the other scale where... Sorry, you can't go too much into it.
No, I mean, you still run the risk of dying.
Yes.
Right? There is still a small chance. But now the odds are in your favor. Right?
You confuse me with that.
Well, before you... Right now, you're fighting a fucking saber-toothed tiger.
Yes.
And he's healthy, you're fucking healthy.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
That is when you don't want to be fucking the tiger, you know, fighting the tiger.
But if the tiger's injured...
But if the tiger is injured and you're still alright, in other words, now you have more of an advantage than he had before,
mm-hmm.
that is not the time to say, I am now content. Because the question to you is, why did you fucking fight the fucking tiger in the first place? If your advantage has improved, why stop?
That's fair.
Right? Because you ought not have begun in the first place. If you begun in the first place because you're trying to be exploratory or being, you know, taking on an adventure, that's why you decided to fuck with the tiger, that mentality will also fuck you up. You can't be too adventurous. You can't go on misadventures, right? So there's a balance of the two. You have to make a relatively informed decision on whether to take on the tiger.
Mm-hmm.
You can take on him one-on-one, that's fine. And often people take on the one-on-one. It's either you run at the beginning, right?
Mm-hmm.
Don't take on the fucking tiger.
Mm-hmm.
But if you decide to take on the fucking tiger, and it's a one-on-one thing, and you and he's more injured than you are, and you say, I am now content, I'm going to fuck off,
mm-hmm.
you fundamentally are numbnuts. Okay. Yeah. Fundamentally, you know, you're lacking oxygen, right? Like, yes. Like, the oxygen is literally being wasted upon you.
How very Huxley. What the hell's his name?
I don't know.
Aldous Huxley. Brave New World. How very Brave New World of you.
Yes. But it makes sense, right? Because at the beginning, you said, I'm going to fight the tiger. Because I think I can win. And that's all the testosterone probably speaking out. I can fight him. And then later on, you know, your advantage improves and you go, oh, actually, this is much tougher than I thought it would be. And so you stop. And you stop not because you're using your mind, it's because you lost the testosterone in you. So the thing that motivated you to fight to begin with wasn't logical. So you should go into it logically.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and when the logic dictates the odds are in your favor, you shouldn't be committing less, you should probably be committing a tiny bit more.
I agree to this point.
Yeah.
I would also like to bring up that logic is not... Your knowledge of the situation is never perfect.
It's not. That's why it's always on a balance of probability. That's why, you know, you have to use intelligence to assess. But basically, people jump into things very randomly. You're faced with things every day that's due to chance and luck more than due to you positioning yourself to be there. It's not like...
So you run into a tiger. There's a chance of running into a tiger. There's a chance of running into a wild pig.
Yeah.
And you just happen upon the
tiger. Yeah, so like, I got like, you know, chicks and, you know, what do they call it? Bitches roll, you know, coming to my doorstep. But once in a while, you know, if a pretty girl comes to my doorstep, I gotta fucking think.
Uh-huh.
You know, do I stay or do I run? Right? Uh-huh. Basically, that's what's going on.
Right.
Right? I have to use my fucking head and start really fucking thinking, right? And that's how genetic material passes down. You think about it. You go, oh shit, you know, her boyfriend will beat me up. So you don't fucking do it.
Fair enough.
Yes. But even if she doesn't have a boyfriend, you can't just go in there and like essentially, you know, commit a crime. Right? It doesn't work that way.
I don't know where the crime is, but okay, continue.
Yes. There needs to be social intelligence. In other words, you have to exercise your mind, exercise your intelligence. Now, the way nature fucks that up for everyone is it puts in hormones in you.
Mm-hmm.
So the only way that men and women get together, basically, is through feeling love,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's very, very difficult. That injection of hormones, which is love, and the injection of testosterone and adrenaline, which is to kill the fucking tiger, they're necessary in caveman days. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, it probably is far less necessary. Nowadays, it's when you are in those moments, you probably have to exercise some common fucking sense.
The sources that you can get these hormones from are now very, very different, and from very vastly different sources.
Yes, I mean, if you're playing a video game and then you go, you know, Leroy Jenkins, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes,
and you go, Leroy, you go in.
More dots,
right? It's not going to work out.
No.
Right? On average, it's not going to work out because so long the other counterparty is using logic and reason more than they're using testosterone, they'll beat you up because testosterone literally rather than give people reason, it's not about reason. It shifts you to becoming a risk taker more than reason. Right? It just means you're more tolerant of dying.
You're more tolerant of dying.
Basically.
What the fuck?
Yeah, okay. you're more tolerant of the of the likelihood of dying. Essentially, it pushes you from a...
So it's not that you believe the reward that the rewards will be better.
No. Definitely not.
Huh.
Definitely not. It's that it makes you think, oh, the possibility of a big reward at least exists and I like it. It makes you shift that way. Right? So
doesn't mean the reward is better? Like no, maybe no, not in no. reality, so, but so, you think
so,
the reward is
so
better.
So let's say there's two doors, right?
Uh-huh.
And one door is heads and the other door is tails.
Uh-huh.
Sorry, there's two doors, each with a 50% chance of opening, right?
Uh-huh.
And on one door, you get a cash prize of $1 million.
And the other one is a donkey.
And the other one is you lose $1 million.
Oh, right. I lose that in this case.
Yeah, right. Like, logically, you go, no, why would I do it, right? But when you have adrenaline and testosterone in you, you forget about... You essentially blindly forget... Or ignore the door with negative $1 million, and you suddenly start to have like this glowing view, glowing, not belief, but just you start dreaming of the $1 million, right?
Mm.
And it just shifts your calculus. You basically think, damn, there's $1 million, I'm going in, baby.
Mm.
Yeah. The facts haven't changed.
No,
gambling. The probabilities haven't changed.
No, casinos still exist.
Right? It's still a it's a zero NPV game.
Mm.
But that's what it is. It's the same with love. You know? 50% this bitch is crazy. 50% bitch a chance that she ain't, right? She ain't crazy.
Love is a zero-sum game?
This is probably... I don't think love is a zero-sum game. I think love overall is definitely... it's positive NPV. I mean, if you didn't have love... Well, you're not gonna have babies.
True.
You won't have babies.
You have to be driven to it.
If you're too logical, you're not gonna have kids. Right.
Okay, that took a turn.
No, it's true, right? Basically, nature evolved to create. I'm not being cynical. I'm just saying, like,
no,
to all the non-audiences out there, like, I love the feeling of love. I'm just telling you, like, how the world fucking is.
No, I understand.
Yes,
but throughout. This whole time, you're like, okay, yes. You need to be logical. You need to run away from the fucking tiger, otherwise yes. You're gonna fucking die.
Yes.
And now you're like, okay, being too logical is not the best thing either.
Being too what?
Logical. Cause
No. Being too logical. Correct. From nature's point of view, because you're not gonna have kids and you're not gonna pass your genetic code.
You think that being more logical means that you should pass your genetics on, because nature would want you to be better. Well, okay, it is in your benefit to be better and pass your own genetic on.
No, not for the majority of people. I mean. Because nature cares about...
survival.
Of the species, yeah. But as an individual,
uh-huh.
You know, it's probably better to be logical. But as a species, no, you want to have a herd mentality. That's the thing. You're more protected being part of a herd than not being part of a herd on average.
And being more logical, what could we call it? Tall poppy syndrome?
Yeah, so in a herd,
uh-huh.
Essentially, in a herd where everyone appears the same from the outside, but inside, internally, every individual is essentially inherently different, unless there's some exceptional people. Those exceptional individuals will do better than the average of that herd.
Mm-hmm. But they're still part of the herd.
But only if they behave differently from the fucking herd.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Uh-huh.
If exceptional people behave the same as the herd and others behave the same as the median person,
uh-huh.
They're essentially not going to behave any better. They're just usually behaving like the median person. So, uh-huh. You understand? It's the input and output. The input of an exceptional person is like exceptionalism. And then it depends what his output is. He could output to become the average median participant.
Uh-huh.
Then he's just an average person.
Uh-huh.
But he has an ability, because he has great inputs, to also produce great outputs.
Uh-huh.
But it's only up to them.
But society says that's a bad idea.
No, I don't know what society says. I think okay, it's very dependent on society.
Naturally, that is a bad idea because you are no longer part of the herd.
I think naturally there is a conflict, and this is what you know what great literature is about, right? Which is like you're sort of like conflicted between whether to be different from those around you and conform and not be seen, right? But everyone believes that they're exceptional in some way.
Everybody wants to believe that they're exceptional. Don't you?
Yes.
It feels good to be exceptional.
Yes, exactly, right?
It feels good to be better. Better
yes.
being
yes.
whatever term.
Yes. Well, and the question is, why do you want to feel better? To be exceptional, right? There's probably something within you, I'm telling you. It's the DNA.
I don't know what it is.
Because, well, you know, it's fucking genetic algorithm. It's like, you need to improve your fitness. Like, you know, the only way the species survive is if we inherently, every individual biases towards trying to be better than each other. And there's like, you have a sense, you need to have a sense of trying to improve yourself all the time.
I am confused. But yes. If I am too fit, I yes. am now not part, I'm then ostracized if I'm too fit?
Exactly. So if
what
you're
the
too,
fuck?
Yes, because, well, you have to figure out what too fit means. Too fit could mean, but are you too fit for this particular environment, or are you too fit across all environment, or are you too fit because you took a big risk? It's unclear, right? Because the environment is changing. For example,
I think we need to define what too fit means right now.
Totally makes sense, right? So, a Neanderthal 20,000 years ago is way fitter than me. Today, if we were living 20,000 years ago. But a Neanderthal...
Because he is fit to his
because he'll kill,
time, society,
because he can
whatever.
Rape me, right? Because he can rape me.
But people can rape you today.
Yeah. But you get what I'm saying?
No, people can rape you today.
No, yes, I can't hunt. I'm small. You know, I don't know how to throw a spear, and my teeth, you know, I have poor eyesight.
Sure.
A Neanderthal is going to kick my ass. 20,000 years ago, right?
Yes.
But as of today,
you
know, I'm more fit than he is.
To your current times and / society.
Exactly, yes. So that's the question. When you talk about fitness, you're correct. Are you talking about fitness at a point in time or across time? And the thing is, across time is a little bit stupid because across time, the thing that solves fitness is evolution.
Yes.
So you don't... So we all need to evolve and adapt a little.
Yes.
But it's unclear, like... how we are going to be, because we're not even going to be alive, so I don't even know whether it matters that much. I'm not even thinking about like these broad pictures. I'm thinking about,
but that's the whole point of civilization, is that that's what separates us from the animals, is that we can pass on our knowledge far, far, far down the line.
Yes. Well, then one of the important things is that people need to have children, and one of the most important factors having children is I guess, it's either love. Or, I mean, 20,000 years ago, it might be like a man's willingness to like rape someone. It might matter. I'm being fucking serious, but I'm pretty sure now it's like you have to love one another, because you know, being a bit rapey is not allowed these days. Basically, right? So you have to love one another. But I think even and that needs to stay on. And those that can feel love for one another is probably going to pass the genes down way better than those that cannot. Even though, so even if I'm super fucking talented, you know, even if I'm like, you know, R3PO, R2D2, whatever, I'm a fucking, you know, like Facebook genius, whatever it is, or Google genius, it doesn't matter. If I can't pass my genome, if I'm not interested in passing on my genome, this, you know, society pretty much has no use for me. I mean, I can pass on
knowledge.
You can pass on knowledge, and you can pass on what you built, and that's useful. But basically, your genome is dead. So,
interesting,
right?
Because you do technically live on, just not your genome doesn't, but your ideas or whatever continue to.
Yes.
What legacy is.
Yes, and if your legacy sort of makes people feel motivated, that's fine. But basically, so what is important, right? Those that can make Google and Facebook and what else? Amazon, they're very important for society.
Now.
For the herd.
Now.
Yes, they're exceptional people, that make the herd's life
mm-hmm.
better.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
But if there's too many of them, then they're just the fucking herd, and they might kill each other and essentially...
To form a monopoly.
No. I mean, if you have too many exceptional people that have too much risk-taking motivation, they'll just destroy the world. They have no problem destroying the world for their own gain. There are people like that. And they are also the people that are very, very exceptional. You have to be...
Have you met people like that
before? Oh, yes, of course. A lot of successful people are very, very cruel and extremist.
But it is these traits that also brought them to where they are.
Oh, yes, of course.
Hmm.
Yes. You need to... you need to be ruthless. It's far easier to be successful. Okay, I don't know if it's far easier. I shouldn't say that, but if you want to be at the tail end of society, so you don't know which one you're going to be, but let's say you can either end up in prison or end up becoming a very, very successful individual.
So you can either... You can either be the one doing the raping, or you could be the little bitch.
Yes.
Basically. Okay.
Those that... If you're on the tail end, basically you have to take a lot of risks. You need a lot of testosterone. And basically, you got to be ruthless. I'm sure on the criminal end of town, that's not... we don't even talk about it. But I personally know... a lot of very successful people that definitely are ruthless. Maybe it makes sense. You wouldn't want to fight against them. Second of all, even if you fight, you're gonna lose. Third of all, they'll take every bit from you and from everyone around you. They're just very ruthless, and that is a good trait to have sometimes. That is probably a good trait to have. If they are on your side, it's a good trait, right?
Is that also a good trait to pass on? Like, is that what...
Well...
Like, in terms of evolution...
Well, the thing is, if they are your friend, yeah, but as a herd, the herd will be scared of such a person. So if they are doing us a favor, yes. If they're no longer doing us a favor, we will want them dead.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That goes in... That can go quite deep.
But that's just how it is, right? That is literally how it is.
Hmm.
Yeah. The who has the highest chance of like dying or being murdered? It's often like a president or king or like a prime minister, right?
Mm.
Yeah. That's just how it is.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I think that's a topic for another. I'd like to expand upon that, but. Yeah.
But if you want to be a hero, you have to take the risk. And you could be the dead hero or the live hero. But they take risks.
Mm-hmm.
They take risks. And sometimes it pays off, sometimes it doesn't. And you don't know how many dead bodies are buried for every successful risk taker. Yeah.
On a tangent.
I think we're already on a fucking tangent, man.
We're on our like third or fourth tangent right now.
Yeah. I feel like we gotta wrap things up.
We should wrap things up half an hour ago.
Yeah. But yes, what is a tangent, right?
My tangent is about herd mentality.
Yes.
Because... But currently, it is framed that being in a herd increases your survivability.
Correct. Generally speaking, yes.
Yet we view...
Not just survivability, if you're injured, people will help you.
Mm-hmm.
And you will feel less... Basically, you're more informed as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the term sheep is derogatory.
It depends by whom,
Is it not derogatory?
I mean, everyone is a sheep. Don't you think so? We're all like, so long you're mimicking somebody or imitating somebody, and we all do it. That's how we grow up. We're all sheep of some kind. So merely being a sheep is not a problem.
I'm just talking about the term itself. It's a term itself.
Not... There's a lot of words that are derogatory. It's used, depends on the context. Being derogatory, I don't think there's a problem.
Hmm. Okay. That was a tangent.
Right. You can be a black sheep. You can be the... What about the golden fleece? There's all types of sheep out there, So it's not necessarily
the case. Golden Fleece was like, the Golden Fleece one died very quickly. Because they wanted the Golden Fleece. It's not good to be the Golden Fleece.
Yeah, but before he died, he was a sheep with a fucking Golden Fleece. Right? That's derogatory. Is that derogatory? I don't know. I mean, you produce wool, there's lanolin, you make makeup. I mean, it's not. It's not derogatory, right? Like, the way people say all types of shit, like, that, you shouldn't think too much into that shit. Anyways, anything else?
No, any of the topics we could go further into, and I'd love to go further into, but...
No, we're gonna get some karaoke going on. Yes. Let's not worry about this. All right, to all the listeners out there, my name is, what is my name? My name is Joe Delicious, aka Gun, Bang. And next to me is Ray Ray. And thank you very much for listening. And Byron, good luck with picking the background music. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.